Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Each week, we bring you interviews and analysis on the struggles affecting poor and working people throughout the U.S. and the world, building the movement for socialism in the United States. I'm your host, Sean Garcia.
In this segment of Liberation Radio, we're going to be discussing the monumental development in the United Kingdom, Britain, with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the British Labour Party. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm interviewing Eugene Puryear, a leader of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who, along with Gloria Larriva, are representing the Party for Socialism and Liberation in the 2016 presidential election campaign. Gloria will be running for president. Eugene is the vice presidential nominee. Welcome, Eugene Puryear.
Thank you so much for having me.
On September 12th, the political situation in the UK, in Britain, and in fact in Europe and perhaps throughout the world was shaken, at least temporarily, by the surprising election of Jeremy Corbyn, a socialist, an anti-war activist, a longtime member of the British Parliament, but someone who is historically a part of the what's called in the UK the hard left. He was a backbencher. He barely won the nomination to compete, and yet he became the overwhelming winner in the contested election for the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition. Tell us what happened and why it happened.
Well, I think it's important that we recognize what's happening as part of a broader worldwide phenomenon that is taking place where people are really willing to fight back against what many people are calling austerity. It's also called neoliberalism, but really is a capitalist offensive that's been going on for almost 30 years, a race to the bottom to reduce the living standards of people all around the world as the labor production system has become more globalized. It's been extremely brutal, and the mainstream parties in almost all of the countries, certainly in the Western world, have been complicit in this. And I think Jeremy Corbyn, just like Bernie Sanders, just like the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, Podemos in Spain, very relevant to the UK, of course, the SNP in Scotland, Sinn Féin in Ireland. There is a growing desire amongst people to, when they go to the ballot box, try to strike a blow against austerity, to vote for parties, I think we could say Syriza in Greece as well, to vote for parties that people believe are going to make a change, who are going to turn around and are going to support pro-people policies, not this endless business drive for profits.
I think there's two parts to the question about Jeremy Corbyn's election in terms of its significance, its long-term significance. One is why it happened, and some of that you just addressed. What's the underlying economic, social, political sort of reality that has impacted on the rise of left forces within the electoral arena in a number of countries? And secondly, and maybe ultimately in a historical sense, this will be the most important part of the question, is what will it mean? Will it be a catalyst for a resurgent radicalism or leftism in the UK? Will it stimulate and promote a fight back amongst British trade unions? Will it enliven the anti-war movements that are sort of coinciding with the anti-racist movements in Europe? So I want you to, if you would, discuss a little bit about what Jeremy Corbyn stands for in a formal way, what his program was. And then we're going to talk about both sides of that question. Again, how did it happen? What seems to be a political earthquake, the election of such a far-left leader, at least from within the bourgeois electoral establishment, and then what its likely outcome will be.
Well, I think it's very interesting because what happened in the Labour Party is that you had a rule change about a year ago that was an attempt by the most right-wing forces, sometimes called the Blairites, followers of Tony Blair, who moved the Labour Party much further to the right than it had been in some time, and that they had changed the rules in terms of who could vote for the leader of the party, which traditionally had a very heavy block vote from unions, which was viewed as a left-wing influence on the party. And thus, there was this idea, well, if we end the affiliation system, the block vote system, in terms of unions being able to vote the way they are and bring it into individuals, then we'll be able to bring in a number of quote-unquote middle-class elements that are the main supporters, this is what they view, the Blairites view, of the Labour Party. What happened instead, however, is that when the individual was allowed to vote and Jeremy Corbyn got on the ballot paper, as it were, he was able to be nominated, it's a convoluted process, many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people actually saw, hey, wait, we have a chance to weigh in on this. Some were disaffected Labour members, some were new voters, many were signed up directly by unions that were urging their members, if you want to have a candidate in the Labour Party who is the leader, who is going to support your struggles, the working class struggles in England, that this is what's going to happen. Because you look at Jeremy Corbyn, he is for the renationalization of the railways, scrapping the Trident nuclear weapons system, really doing a robust continuation of the National Health Service in England, which is the socialized healthcare that they have there, which is under serious attack, the social housing there, the council housing, which is the public housing in the UK, also under attack. Jeremy Corbyn wants to revive this. So his program is, you know, yes, as many would say, it's a reform program, but it's one that goes, you know, turns back the clock in England almost to the pre-Margaret Thatcher days, to where these horrible attacks that have been happening on working class people in the UK, he is opposed to almost all of these issues. And you saw individuals in their hundreds of thousands stream into the Labour Party and become members. So in a way, the right wing of the Labour Party was hoisted on their own petard, is their change in the system opened up space for many, many, many people to intervene in the process.
And Jeremy Corbyn said, as you rightly note, that the individuals who came out surprisingly voted for the most left-wing candidate. I mean, he won overwhelmingly. There were four candidates. He had almost 60% of the vote. The other three, the more conservative candidates, shared the last 40%. But in his acceptance speech, or in his one of his opening speeches, Corbyn said he wanted to note that it was the young people in the UK, the young people in Britain, the young people who have been hurt so hard by globalized capitalism, who came into this and changed the political equation. Is that really what happened?
I think you see that absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I thought was very interesting about Corbyn's campaign is he consistently focused on the youth, and he consistently pointed out that it really is about, you know, not necessarily people like him who are older, but the future of the country for young people. And were they going to grow up in this terrible situation of austerity? Were they going to have their future essentially erased and sacrificed on the altar of the profits of the big banks and the big businesses? Or were they going to create a better world? And I think that resonated with a lot of young people.
Let me ask you a question, especially for our American listeners who may be less familiar with the UK's political system. Obviously, it's a parliamentary system and thus different. But there are a lot of comparisons that are made in general between the Labour Party, which is the sort of liberal and left and pro-labor or pro-union party historically in the UK, although it went sharply to the right under Tony Blair following the assaults waged against the labor movement and the working class by Margaret Thatcher in the 80s. But comparing that organization with the Democratic Party. And of course, for leftists, there's a debate, you know, in the United States, should you work within the Democratic Party, the more, quote, left wing or liberal or to the left of the very, very, very right wing Republican Party. And likewise, in the UK, there's a debate, should leftists operate within the Labour Party and try to see the Labour Party as a vehicle for change? Or is that party, because of its connection to British imperialism historically, even with its class composition being with the unions, is it just a lost cause? That's a question, and I want to get to that question if we have time, but I'd like you to explain to the American listener, what's the similarity and what's the difference between the Democratic Party in the United States and the Labour Party in the UK?
Well, the similarity is, I think, speaks to some of what you just said in terms of Labour carrying out a lot of the imperialist agenda, a lot of the Cold War agenda, is that it functioned as the second major party, really helping keep the stability in the broader British capitalist system. But unlike the Democratic Party, which is essentially an imperialist party designed to capture the votes of a large section of the population and channel them towards imperialism, the Labour Party was really started as the party of the labor bureaucrats. It was Lenin, the Russian revolutionary, who said it was a bourgeois workers' party, but despite that, the radical revolutionary organizations should seek to affiliate to the Labour Party, because what it represented is sort of a similar concept of, you know, working within the unions, which often have bad leadership, but are aimed at directing working class power against the capitalist class. Now, the Labour Party obviously has not always served that role, and since the Blairite counter-revolution, if you will. It's more directly operated as a bourgeois party, but nevertheless, it's a party that historically has represented the interest of working people. It's in the name, the Labor Party. Their theme is the red flag, about the red flag coming out of the Paris Commune. And so certainly it's an organization that workers look to as an instrument of struggle, and it existed really as an organization that existed as an instrument of struggle of working class leaders and organizations on the political plane. Now, they had a reformist outlook, yes, but I think that's a very serious difference with the Democratic Party, which is simply just a creation of millionaires and billionaires in order to capture the energy of mass movements. Of course, the modern Democratic Party having its origins in co-opting the populist party in terms of its mass appeal.
And in the 1800s, when workers in the UK, in Britain, were getting the right to vote, same with in Germany and elsewhere, they used that franchise, that right to vote, to form working class parties or labor parties or socialist or social democratic parties. In the United States, labor never really formed a party. It affiliated with either one or the other of the capitalist parties. The Democratic Party had its roots within the slaveocracy in the United States. It represented the Southern capitalist ruling class, which based itself on chattel slavery. In the UK, what really happened? How did that Labour Party get formed? And what's the difference in terms of consciousness that it impacts? And when people go to vote, in the United States, people are voting for the lesser evil, perhaps, or for individuals or for personalities. But the working class has never had a consciousness about its own party. How does that impact consciousness in the UK?
Well, I think it impacts consciousness in a huge way. I mean, first of all, it injects class directly into that. I mean, if you look in the United States, for instance, and I think this is the clearest example, when you're looking for class-based statistics, you often really have to construct your own data set in terms of trying to shape class. In the UK, class is often used as an official data point, and the way people conceive not only of themselves, of their life, but even the way that official organizations and institutions conceive of how they gather data and how they construct their models in terms of how people behave. And this is not just the working class organizations, it's the bourgeois, it's the capitalist organizations. I think having your own party that represents the interest of workers explicitly, whether or not we think at either particular time it was representing them well, the fact that it explicitly states, well, we are representing the labor movement writ large, workers' interest in the political process, has clearly had a deep impact inside of the consciousness of the United Kingdom, which has a history of many, many different left-wing radical socialist parties that have done many interesting and exciting things. And I think certainly that base level class consciousness that is created by having in the mainstream political sphere a organization that is explicitly for and by workers allows them to have a different form of consciousness than in America, where you're consistently not supposed to have class consciousness. In fact, it's encouraged to have sort of a trans class or a fake class consciousness by either, you know, lumping people together by whatever method or using terms like middle class.
The Labour Party, as an explicit labor party, as an explicit working class party, also was rooted in affiliated unions. It had almost two wings, right? A parliamentary wing, which was historically dominated by more bourgeois elements, and then the trade union section of the party, which is, of course, a working class organization. But the Labour Party has followed a pro-imperialist policy when in power. You could see that in terms of its orientation when in power, when it had the prime ministership towards the British colonies. It didn't challenge the existence of the British Empire or the colonization or semi-colonization of people throughout what was then called the Third World or the developing world. But Corbyn represents somebody who is an anti-imperialist. He stood with Palestine. He has stood up against the U.S.-British war against Iraq. He has taken a very progressive and internationalist position. On January 18, 2003, he was a featured speaker here in Washington, D.C. at the Answer Coalition demonstration of 500,000 people on the Mall in the lead-up to the Iraq war. Is Corbyn capable as a leader, as an individual, or as a trend to take labor, the Labour Party, into an anti-imperialist direction, or is that a question that remains to be seen?
Well, in some ways, it remains to be seen because we're not quite sure what he's going to be able to push through. I mean, obviously, not only are they not the party in power, not only is capitalist politics a difficult way to push real change, and beyond that, even many members of his own party are attempting to undermine him. But I think so far, it's been tremendously encouraging. I mean, from his support for refugees to his continuing to stand strong in terms of the issue of Palestine, continuing to raise throughout his campaign the criticism that he had made of the Iraq war and the apology that he wanted to make for the Iraq war even happening. It seems as if Mr. Corbyn is not backing down from his stances that have been quite good and that have really marked him as a part of the anti-imperialist left in the UK and around the world. And so certainly in terms of his own pronouncements, I think very much that he is capable of bringing a new element and starting to channel a lot of the anti-war energy that exists in the UK back into the parliament, where it's, you know, to a large degree, except for the backbenchers, been off the table. I mean, it was Tony Blair that took them into Iraq. And then obviously the Conservatives have continued similar policies. But I think certainly we're now going to see from the opposition bench a fairly trenchant critique of the foreign policy of the UK, which by extension is the foreign policy of the United States and the broader imperialist club.
Eugene, my final question has to do with this. Electoral politics is one arena. Parliament is an attached arena. Neither arena are really the centerpiece for revolutions, which take place in the streets, take place at the barricades. And the question is, will the Corbyn election to the head of the Labour Party, the opposition party, will it also stimulate the working class trade union struggle and broader class struggle in the UK? There are many signs from within the labor movement that that's just what some of the union leaders are hoping for, that without a big labor-based fight back, that the British working class, like the U.S. working class, like the working class in all the advanced industrial countries, is in a race to the bottom as a consequence of globalization. Is it, in your opinion, likely that there will be a stimulation of class struggle, real class struggle, outside of the parliamentary arena?
I think that it is likely. You know, obviously, we can't predict the future. I think, obviously, we've seen many of the labor leaders have come out with very strong statements, many saying they want to try to bring down the government of David Cameron. I think what we've seen is, irrespective of the politics in the street, a growing politics of protest in the UK that is certainly very significant and very interesting. There's a long history, obviously, of class struggle, so there is a good reserve of individuals who have been organizing. And so I think having this added element, which someone who's day in, day out in the media, the leader of the second major party, continuing to push this anti-austerity line in a political system where the only way for them to get significant change is going to be to destabilize the government in the streets, to try to lay the groundwork for a new election sooner than the next scheduled election, which can bring some relief, means that individuals will almost essentially have to connect their voting for Corbyn to mass struggle if it's to mean anything. Now, obviously, there are a number of obstacles in his way. Obviously, there will be tremendous pressure on him to do a U-turn around on many of his positions. But I think the initial signs point to the possibility for renewed class struggle. And that being said, to go back to my first point, I think that's what is significant. Obviously, the actions of individuals and organizations will be key to making this a real thing. I mean, there's no real way to say this is guaranteed to be the outcome, or that, you know, ahead of time he's going to sell people out, or ahead of time it's going to lead to the revolution. We do not know. The actions, the concrete actions of people will be what's key, and we can't predict that. But the thaw that we are starting to see in the neoliberal counter-revolution that's been going on for 30-some-odd years at this stage in the game, even though it's being expressed through elections, sort of the path of least resistance, it's a sign that there is a thaw. There is the possibility for renewed struggle, and I think that ultimately is the message we should take away from this.
We're speaking with Joel Gallego, a regular contributor to Liberation News and a member of the PSL in New Mexico. We get a chance to speak about the often less talked about depletion of the Oglala Aquifer, one of the largest underground water sources in the world. Joel, can you tell us more about the aquifer and where is it located and a few of the purposes it serves?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people don't know about the Oglala Aquifer. A lot more people are aware of the drought in California. The Oglala Aquifer is actually located in the Midwest, right in the middle of the country in the U.S. And it's one of the largest underground sources of fresh water, not just here in the United States, but the entire world. It provides drinking water to about 1.8 million people. And it's under eight different states. The states include South Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska, Colorado, Kansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Texas. It's named Oglala, similar to the name for the Native American peoples of South Dakota. Being as that it's one of the largest underground sources of fresh water in the world, and it does provide drinking water to 1.8 million people, this makes this issue particularly frightening. It will be depleted in about 50 years, it's estimated.
Mm. And so how exactly have we gotten to this state? And, you know, what went wrong? What's been going on that is getting the depletion kind of accelerated?
So one of the things with any aquifer is that aquifers oftentimes are filled over millions of years. It takes millions of years to fill up an aquifer to its capacity. Even if we were to stop pumping now, today, it would take 6,000 years to replenish itself naturally. And that's what geologists currently say. And so, you know, the way that we got to this point was the fact that, you know, agribusiness itself has been pumping without any sort of regard for the environment, even though they've known about its depletion since for about 50 years, they've known about its depletion.
Yeah. So what effects does the depletion and the state of the aquifer have on the region that it's, you know, directly underneath, but also the rest of the country?
Right. So one of the hugest dilemmas is that $20 billion worth of food a year is produced using the Oglala Aquifer water. In fact, 30% of all groundwater irrigation for the entire country comes from the Oglala Aquifer. So out of all of the groundwater irrigation that we use, and you know, some places use surface water irrigation, such as rivers, lakes, so on and so forth. But underground water, out of all of the underground water irrigation, out of all the underground water irrigation that's done in the country, 30% of that is provided by the Oglala Aquifer, and it supplies water to eight states, the ones that I listed earlier.
Since it's such an essential aquifer and it services so many states and affects agriculture so deeply, you know, what could we have done 50 years ago? What was the responsibility of those and to make the decisions? What decisions should they have made 50 years ago?
You know, when this was discovered around 50 years ago, the fact that it was being depleted faster than it could be replenished, some immediate steps could have been taken, but one thing we could have done was at least put together a team of experts, individuals who are skilled in the science around water and water systems, geologists, so on and so forth, putting our resources into finding out a better way to use our irrigation. I know there are different technologies that are currently being implemented on small-scale farms, such as drip systems and also underground irrigation systems that conserve water, you know, in a dramatic way. And these are systems that are not being implemented because it's more profitable and it's much faster to just pump the water out of a well and not have any regard for future generations. It's, you know, it's really sad that, you know, just because it's more profitable to ignore the problem, you know, they're putting at risk the futures and lives of millions of people.
And so now that there's been more public exposure about the issue, has there been a slowing down of the pumping? Has there been steps taken to try to address the issue? And is there any organizations or groups organizing to defend the aquifer?
A lot of the local farmers, smaller farms, more localized farms have simply said that the only way that they can, the only way that they can conserve water is by growing less crops. Because the problem has already advanced so much, there's little that can be done today other than cut back on the crop space and crop yields. And so there's not much that can be done today other than at a local level to moderate water usage. But just like anywhere else where we talk about drought, the tactic seems to be just to drill more and drill deeper. The Oglala Aquifer in some places has already ran completely dry. There are areas that no longer pump water. Some of these places are in Kansas. There's many different areas in Kansas that no longer produce any water. Something needs to be done or else this is going to be a huge catastrophe. Like I said, it's projected that within 50 years, the entire aquifer will be completely dry.
And so if that's the case, and like you said, we're so, it seems, systematically entrenched in this kind of abusive nature to the aquifer, you know, so what would we, if we were living in a socialist U.S., what would be some steps we would take to switch things around today?
Yeah, so, I mean, as you know, the wealthy landowners, agribusiness, all these individuals, they care nothing about future generations. They can, you know, they have the luxury of just going somewhere else if the water runs out. And, you know, just to put it in perspective as to how powerful these companies are, in 2014 and alone, agribusiness spent over $127 million lobbying politicians. I mean, in the last 10 years, agribusiness has spent over $1.2 billion, that's billion with a B, in lobbying government officials. And so, you know, it's no wonder that the politicians have done nothing. You know, under socialism, that wouldn't happen. Under socialism, what we could have is we could have a planned approach to this. People would be educated about the issue. The entire public would take part in the discussion as to how to remedy the problem. That includes not only people from the scientific community, but also farmers, individuals who know how to work the land. And innovation can come through that, through those two groups cooperating together. Unfortunately, agribusiness doesn't seem to be too concerned with the scientific community if it's not going to be yield in higher profits. It is, you know, they tend to ignore science and the scientific community if there's not profits involved. This would be completely opposite under socialism. Under socialism, it would be integral to our development as a nation to have both in the farming industry and the scientific community working together to try to fix these goals rather than working against each other as they do currently in today's system.